Welcome to the Love Choice Hour, sponsored by Cooker, 100 degree boiling hot water straight from your kitchen tap. I want to thank them for continuing to support these podcasts. Lovely people there. Not only are they a great company, their product is also great. It's one of those things that if you get it, you will absolutely love it. If you can afford one, I recommend it. Go to cooker.co.uk. That's Q-U-O-O-K-E-R.co.uk for more information and to look at the different models. Mine also does chilled filtered water and chilled sparkling filtered water too. It's love it. I love it. Use it every day. Majorly good thing. Right, today, I'm curious about how you teach the pros how to sing. Or can anyone sing, I suppose, is the other. You're going to love this, by the way. I thoroughly enjoyed doing this podcast today. This conversation is with Michael Dorr, who's a vocal coach and has worked with film actors including Taron Egerton on film Sing and Rocketman and Emma Watson on Disney's Beauty and the Beast. He's also worked on the TV series Any Dream Will Do and The X Factor. He was also vocal consultant on the TV documentary for Dame Vera Lynn's 100th birthday. He's got loads of stories. He's very into singing and into explaining me, who's not very smart when it comes to singing, all about it. I thoroughly enjoyed it, and I think you will too. Can you sing, by the way? If you're listening to this, can you sing? And no, I can't. Let's meet him. Here's Michael. Hello, Michael. How are you?
Hi, Tim. Yeah, I'm good, thank you. Yeah, how are you?
Yeah, very good. Where in the country am I speaking to you from today?
I'm an Essex boy now. Well, just literally over the border from London by about a mile.
Right.
So a place called Buckhurst Hill.
Because I'm wondering, the first thing I was thinking about was, I wonder if this is your industry basically London based? I mean, for everything you do, is that the best place to be still?
Yeah, definitely. Yeah, yeah, it's still all centered around London because a lot of what I do is studio work, and nearly all of the studios are in the center of London. Abbey okay. Road, Lyndhurst, you know, the big studios are all in town, really.
Does it make a difference when you go to somewhere like Abbey Road? Do you feel the histories there? Does it rub off on you when you do something?
Yeah, definitely. I mean, it's always exciting to just walk in the building because you know that all of the greats have recorded there, and I'm often in Studio 2, which of course is where the Beatles did all of their stuff. And they've not changed it since the 60s, so it looks exactly the same as it did, you know, 50 years ago or whatever, you know.
But what are the acoustics like? Are they still good?
Yeah. Oh God, it's amazing. Yeah. And I think that's why they've never changed it. You know, there's a smaller studio which is completely revamped. But the main, you know, the huge studio that all the orchestras record in, Studio One, that's exactly the same as it was. You know, they haven't changed it. So the control room is different. They've modernized the control room in all three studios. But the actual, you know, studio itself where you record is just exactly the same. You know,
you're obviously very precise with your vision of the voice, your understanding of it. You obviously clearly can hear the intricacies of a voice. We'll get onto that in a minute, just because I've got a good question on that. Well, I think it's a good question, but just tell me, what do you do day to day? I know we're going to obviously talk about you being a vocal coach and things like that, but what do you do day to day now? How does your time fill up?
My timetable changes every week. You know, there's no set pattern because I do concerts and cabarets, I do studio sessions, and I do my coaching. So all of that moves around. You know, my coaching I do depending on my availability. So anybody I take on for vocal coaching, I always say we have to arrange it per session, because, you know, I can't say I'll see you every Wednesday, you know, at 3 o'clock or something, because I might have a studio session or I might be rehearsing for a concert or a broadcast or something, you know.
Yeah, how is your voice at the moment? Are you the tip top form? Are you still getting better?
I think it's okay. I've got a cabaret. I appear at Crazy Cox, Piccadilly, twice a year, and I've got my sort of mid year one next Sunday, May the 1st. So I'm back there. So when I've got like a big gig, you know, I've got a concert. I just did a big concert at Symphony Hall in Birmingham. That was, I think, sort of 2 weeks ago. And you know, when there is a big date, then you know, I work it more. I practice more. You know, because I have to learn things, I have to memorize things, but also I have to work the songs into my voice. So that, you know, so I am on tip-top form.
What does that mean, work the songs into your voice?
Well, you know, you have to sing through everything to make sure that it's going to sound right. And what I do with the people that I teach and coach, I do for myself. So I'll record myself singing the songs. And then I'll check myself and I'll think, right, no, you need to do this on that note. You need to do that. And that phrasing is not quite right. And technically you need to sort this out. So, you know, I do exactly the same with myself as I do with anybody that I coach.
Right. The point I was going to make about being precise is you talk about, I'm just listening to my voice here. I moved from a kitchen, which was really sort of like tinny, into, yeah, now I'm calling it the podcast room, but it's a spare bedroom. And it also has a lot of reflection, I feel, off the walls. I can sort of hear it in my microphone because I'm using sort of better equipment these days. When you arrive at a recording studio or a venue or something like that, are you aware of the sound changing because you know the voice so well? If you're like playing somewhere like the Royal Albert Hall, are you thinking the acoustics here are amazing? Or are you thinking, hold on a second, they could do something with the acoustics? I mean, how does it work like that when you come in? Do you analyze your voice and hear the way it sounds?
Definitely. I mean, the most important thing is to make sure that you have good sound in your headphones or you have good sound in your, you know, fallback speakers, whichever you're using. That slightly affects the way you sing, but basically, you know, the way you've rehearsed something is the way you will do it, and then you put your trust in the sound engineer. I always say that the sound engineer is the most important person, yeah, because it doesn't matter what we do, you know, if the sound engineer gets it wrong, you know, then, you know, that's, you know, they are the most important person.
You know, that's exactly the same thing in TV terms is the sound man does nothing, right, apart from stand there on every shoot you do, or the sound men will hate me for this. But they'll mic you up and they'll stand there with a boom and they'll do nothing all day long. They'll do nothing. And yet they're the most important person, because if you get crap pictures, you can always make it look arty or do something. If you get crap sound, there's nothing you can do with crap sound. So they are the, yeah, most important person, and exactly, they do nothing apart from they set you up at the beginning and then hopefully it works whilst the actual shoot's on or while the program's on. They're really not doing a lot.
I mean, I think, you know, like, you know, when I do the Albert Hall, which I've fortunately done many, many times, and that is notoriously difficult for a sound engineer, particularly, you know, when you've got a huge orchestra and you might have a number of soloists, you might have a choir, you know, and everybody is mic'd. And, you know, that must be a nightmare for them. You know, I mean, the, yeah, sound engineer, when I do my cabarets, they're very intimate. It's just me and very often just a piano or a piano and bass, and the sound engineer, and that's it. And it's a small, intimate room. So that's easier. But, you know, when you're doing a big venue like the Albert Hall, you know, it's the sound engineer really has to be completely, you know, on the top of their game.
Is it good acoustics in the Royal Albert Hall, though? Because I've worked there a lot, but and all the artists, I do the Teenage Cancer Trust, or I used to be the host for it,
right, yeah,
the compare, and basically they were getting huge bands constantly because people wanted to play there, and it was a weird thing because so many great big stars would play it and bands would play it at the top of their game, and they would, you know, they wouldn't be making any money out of it. It doesn't have a TV profile, it doesn't have a massive profile, but people do it because A, the charity's brilliant,
yeah,
Roger Daltrey runs it, fantastic, what a top man he is, and And B, people want to say they played the Royal Albert Hall. I remember Bill Burr, the comedian, coming over here and saying, I just want to play the Royal Albert Hall because so many great legends of the music world have played there. Yeah. And when you walk around that downstairs bit, as you know, all the legends of the faces of all the big stars who have played there, it gives you a bit of like, the hair stand on the back, up on the back of your neck, don't they? It's that sort of feeling.
Completely. I mean, as a kid, I remember seeing... one of the performers that I love the most is Shirley Bassey. And I remember the first time I went to the Albert Hall as a teenager, I remember just walking in the building and just being absolutely dumbstruck, you know, because it's such a special place. And, you know, for those people who haven't been in there, you know, it's worth a trip to London just to go in the Albert Hall, even if you don't actually, you know, sit in a performance of anything, because it's such a special place. I love it. It's my, you know, it's my favourite concert. Well, I've been lucky. I've sung at the Sydney Opera House. I've sung at Carnegie Hall. You know, I've played in a lot of big concert halls around the world, but the Albert Hall is still my favourite.
But is that for historical reasons, or is there actually the acoustics? Which one is the greatest?
No, the acoustics are notoriously bad. they're known for being bad. I mean, when it was first built, if you look up to the ceiling, you know, there are those mushroom things that hang down from the centre of the auditorium, and they were put in after the place was built, because the sound was so boomy, it was just so swimmy. And so, you know, it's a tricky job for the sound people to make sure that the sound is right. And you get a different sound that, you know, if you walk around the hall, the sound changes. You know, if you walk around during the rehearsal, you can hear the sound changing from side to side.
Right. Okay. Yeah. Talking about the sound guys, going back to that and mixing it, it's very important, isn't it, to get the vocal in the right. I know nothing about music, by the way, Michael, so I'm going to talk to you like I'm stupid. Well, I am a bit stupid, especially when it comes to music. But I remember going to the Rolling Stones exhibition at the Saatchi Gallery, and they had this one bit in it which I thought was amazing. They had I can't remember which song it was. One of their songs, anyway. And they had they'd isolated all the different parts of the music, the vocal, the bass, the guitar, the drums and everything. And then they had it at the mix, and then you could remix it, and it sounded just crap when you moved it away, because we're so used to the way it was mixed. But what I thought was really interesting is how high stroke low the vocal was in it, because we all look at the vocal as being the most important part. And if you put it a bit too low, it will obviously get lost. If you put it too high, it then doesn't fit with the music. So that job of getting the vocal right with the music,
yeah,
in the background,
getting
is very important,
the balance is incredibly important. And very often, you know, with a solo voice, you have to hear that above the orchestra, because very often, you know, it's lyrics, and everybody has to hear the lyrics. You're not, you know, the voice is not blending in to sort of match the oboe or the string section or whatever. I do a wide variety of material, and I do a piece called Sinfonia by Luciano Berio, which is it's a sort of contemporary classical piece, which is for eight solo voices and symphony orchestra. And what's bizarre about that piece is that the eight solo voices are not meant to be completely on top of the orchestral sound the whole time. So what happens is that you will hear bits of what each of the soloists is singing or saying. I have a lot of French to speak, a lot of, you know, a lot of chatter, a lot of funny noises to make, as well as singing. And Luciano wrote it for it not always to be completely clear. So, you know, people would say, it's just reminded me, I did one performance at Huddersfield Town Hall. And what normally happens is that the eight solo voices sit round the conductor with the orchestra behind. And on this particular occasion at Huddersfield Town Hall, the stage wasn't big enough to have us sitting round the conductor. So they put the eight of us right at the back of the stage on a higher platform, which then meant that there was enough room for the orchestra. And what Radio 3 were recording the concert. Sadly, it wasn't live. If it had been live, it would have been amazing because, and you know, Yorkshire people, and I'm a northern boy, will very often say what they think. Like Italian audiences, you know, I've been in concerts in Italy where people have shouted things. And in this particular occasion...
Michael, I can't wait for the punchline of this. Come on.
Well, what happened was somebody stood up and said, "Kaya, the bloody singers." And Luciano was conducting. He stopped conducting, turned round to Hugh, our sound engineer, and said, "Hugh, what do you think?" And Terry Edwards, who was the fixer, he stood up and said, "It has not been a disaster." And all of this was being recorded by Radio 3. And I just wish it had been a live recording, because then that would have gone out, you know.
That'd be fantastic.
And then what happened was, you know, we went to the second movement, third, fourth movements, fifth movement, did the whole thing. But Luciano had completely lost it because of all this chaos that was going on in the audience. And all his tempos were all over the place. He just wanted to get out of the building and back on a plane to Italy, you know. It was just the most bizarre thing. And I think it was partly because, you know, the people in the audience saw us standing up at the back, looking like, you know, sort of major soloists. They thought they were going to hear arias or, you know, big songs, you know, for those people that didn't know the piece. And a lot of it, they couldn't hear us. But that was what he wanted. So weird.
Fantastic. Tell us a bit about your history then. How did you get involved in singing in the first place?
Well, I was born in Grimsby, and my parents entertained locally. My dad was a welder. My mum was a hairdresser. And what happened was that for fun, mum had always sung from being a little girl. You know, she sang in music festivals. And so she was always a singer. It was always something she loved doing. And it was only when my dad was 45, he'd got fed up of mum going out and doing little, you know, jobs and gigs and so mum's singing teacher suggested to my dad that he should pick up a guitar, learn the guitar, and then he could accompany mum. So that's what they did. And and dad was a welder with quite thick, you know, fingers, but he managed, you know, he mastered the guitar, and they went out entertaining. So from being little, I always, you know, there was always music in the house. You know, my sister did the same thing. You know, we sang, we learned the piano. So I was always, music was always in my, you know, in my ears from being small. And actually, so was Perm Solution was in my nose as well, because I was so used to people, you know, ladies coming to the house and having their hair done. So if I hadn't been a singer, I would have been a hairdresser. So it was my parents, you know, it was, you know, the family. My uncle sang. So I sort of grew up with it, and I'm pretty rubbish at anything else. So you know, I'm so pleased that I've had a career in music. You know.
So when did you first start making money at it?
Making money.
When did it become like a career then? When did you say, right, I can do this full time?
Well, sort of when I was early teens. I remember once my mum and dad were asked to do a gig, a sort of local gig. And they'd already got something on. So mum said, well, my son sings. So I went and took my friend Kay, who negotiated my fee, which I think was all of £5.
Perfect.
So, and they sort of gave us a bit of a dirty look, as if that was, you know, a huge amount of money. But professionally, I suppose when I was about 20, because I went to the Guildhall School of Music in London, moved from Grimsby to London, trained at the Guildhall School of Music and Drama, and then joined the Swingle Singers, which was, you know, it's still going. It's a group that started in the 60s in Paris. Then Ward Swingle, who ran the group, moved to England, started an English group, And then along, you know, over like 50 years, various people have been in the group. So like I joined that from college.
It's like a vocal group, isn't it?
It's an eight-part vocal group. And it's quite intricate stuff because the original group used to just do instrumental pieces. You know, they would take, you know, the Marriage of Figaro overture or Bach fugues and sing them. You know, lots of notes, you know, all that sort of thing. And they had huge hits around the world. You know, they had gold records, they won 5 Grammys, you know. And so it was all scat because they were instrumentalists who sang, basically. And Ward Swingle was a studio musician in Paris. And they just got together and sang these Bach fugues that were normally played, you know. And they sang, you know, just with nonsense syllables, you know, all that sort of thing. And they had this huge success. But after 10 years of touring the world, Ward got slightly bored. And so he moved to England because of the great choral tradition here, and recruited 8 singers to form what was originally called Swingle 2.
How was that? Was it hard work to do?
Yeah, I mean, initial, it was like a 2-hour program. So when I first joined, I had to memorize millions of notes for a 2-hour program. And so I remember spending the whole of the summer just memorizing. You know, I learnt a piece every day and started a new piece, and then, you know.
So let's get on to coaching. We'll come back. I've got more questions on that, but I'd quite be interested to talk about the coaching. How did you get involved in coaching? Because obviously one of the things that you're known for now is training Taron Egerton to sing like Elton John and Emma Watson to be in Disney's Beauty and the Beast. How does that come along, and how do you go about doing things like that?
Well, I suppose it all started. What I call my day job, which was a regular thing that I had, because as a freelance singer, you know, nothing is particularly guaranteed. You know, you don't get a regular income from anything. But having said that, I sang in the vocal booth at Cats the Musical for years, for like 18 years, unbelievably. But I only did 4 shows a week. Somebody else did my part for 4 shows a week. And then what happened was, when I got a tour or got a gig or a session or whatever, as long as I got the show covered, I could go off and do the other things. So that was brilliant. Now, when the show stopped, that regular income stopped too. So in fact, a friend who sang in the booths, she was a teacher at Performance College, which is a dance college. Well, it's a musical theatre college, primarily dancers. And she said there were just 2 of them, 2 women who ran the singing department. And she said, "We've got all these guys," she said, "and we're not really wanting to teach the guys how to sing. Will you come in and do that?" And it was perfect timing because my regular income had stopped at Cats. So I then went to Performance College to teach there. So that became a regular thing. Again, it didn't get in the way because I took the job on saying, "Look, if, you know, when I get a session or I get a concert or I get a tour, you know, I'll get somebody into debt for me, but I will, you know," singing was always the priority. So anyway, that's how I started the teaching, and I started doing private teaching, and then I met a wonderful lady called Helena Chanel, and I met her basically because I wanted a teacher myself, because even though I'd been doing it for like 20 years, I was starting to do a lot for Radio 2, you know, guesting with BBC Concert Orchestra and doing lots of concerts with them. And they kept saying, "Oh, can you sing this? Or can you sing that?" And sometimes things were like, "Oh my God, that's a bit high, you know." Oh. So I thought, right, I need to go to somebody who is not going to try and make me into an opera singer, but is going to help me technically. And I knew of Helena Chanel's work because she'd worked with Peter Gabriel, Shirley Bassey, George Michael, Lulu, Annie Lennox. I mean, just a whole load of people to help them technically. And so I went to her, we became great friends, and she encouraged the coaching, basically. I learned a lot from her about singing technique. As a result, I started then doing my own stuff.
But how did you get someone like Taron? Because he's a great guy, isn't he, by the way? I've interviewed him a few times.
Yeah, oh, he's fab. Yeah, he's a lovely guy.
When he did Rocket Man, the Elton John thing, I'm not a massive fan of those things, often those where they kind of try and imitate someone. But I thought he did that so well. I really enjoyed that film. How'd you get him to sound like Elton John? Because he did. Could he already sing?
Yeah, he could definitely sing. Well, he trained at RADA, so they did some singing there. And, you know, he was already a good singer, you know. What happened was I was asked to work with him on Sing, the original Sing movie, in which he played Johnny the Gorilla. And he was only singing three songs. And I worked with him. We did two or three sessions. Just one second.
I love that film, by the way.
Mm.
Sing, it's good. I actually didn't know he was the gorilla.
Yeah, he's the gorilla. Well,
I always wonder why they put celebrities as the people as the characters. Because
film was full of people.
I know, but I always watch those with my daughter, and then I don't care who's singing or who's doing it because I'm looking at a cartoon. But surely they could get someone for cheaper. But anyway, carry on.
Well, yeah, I don't know how that works. because you wouldn't necessarily need famous names to do it.
I suppose it
would cost a lot of money to get all those people in.
It sells the film, I suppose. Yeah, exactly.
But what happened was, I think it was just three songs we worked on for that. And one of them was I'm Still Standing. And basically, because of that, he got Rocket Man. I mean, that was it. Because, you know, the powers that be liked what he did and said, oh, actually, you know, we think he would be right to play Elton. And so when, you know, they were starting, when he got the job and all of that, he asked for me to work with him on Rocket Man. So I got a call from Giles Martin, and it's funny because he said, oh, hi, Mike, this is Giles Martin, you know, and Taron's recommended you and all this sort of thing. And the name didn't ring a bell, and which is bizarre, really, because I had a meeting with him and Taron at Abbey Road. And it was only when I walked into Abbey Road, I thought, oh, my God, Giles Martin, son of George Martin. I thought, oh, come on, Michael, wake up, you know. So, yeah, we worked quite a few months, just Taron and I in studios, just getting him ready for it.
Did you have to change his voice to make him sound like Elton then? Is that
the main thing was that he was used to doing music theatre and projecting and right, you know, working in a big space. And, you know, one of the first things we did was I got him to sit down at the piano, which he wasn't a pianist, he doesn't play. But he sat down at the piano and I said, just, you know, sing into this microphone as if you're just talking to me. You're not projecting. That was one of the first things we did.
Right.
Because, you know, it was a case of only, it had to be a microphonic sound rather than a projected sound. So that was one of the first things we did.
Hmm. Can Elton John sing?
I missed that.
Can Elton John sing?
Oh yeah, most definitely. Yeah, yeah.
I always wonder about pop rock. Let's call them pop or rock stars, because you've got like Elton John, and you've got David Bowie, Terry Hall, Mick Jagger. None of them would get past the first round of X Factor, would they? Because everyone would go, oh mate, you can't really, you're not banging out a tune, because they've just got really beautiful individual voices that I adore. But, you know, you've worked on X Factor. It's they're not singing classically, are they? You know, as you're supposed to sing. They're,
no, but I think, you know, it's individual voices. That's what people are interested in.
Yeah.
Do you know what I mean? So it, you know, it's some of the, you know, some of the most interesting singers are not technically very, very sound. But they, you know, they have an interesting voice, you know, and that draws us to them. What you know, just thinking about the coaching thing again, what happened with Helena was that her friend, who was a throat specialist, he used to send people to Helena because people, particularly rock singers, who had done it for years, just naturally, you know, after a while, it was going, the voice was not lasting. So that's where Helena came in, you know. And in fact, you know, Shirley's, you know, one of the great examples, because Shirley worked with Helena for over 30 years, you know, from time to time, you know, not every week, but, and Shirley's voice changed and got better. As a result of the lessons. I mean, Shirley Bassey's voice was always great from the start. You know, she always had a great voice. But you know, some people went to her who didn't have a good voice or were just sounding really raspy. You know, because they didn't really know what they were doing.
Let's examine that a bit then. What is singing? Because there's so many points we're making here about voices getting exhausted and I don't know, you were talking about different forms of things like operatic performances and the different things. What actually is it? What's going on? How, such a stupid question. What is singing? But what is it? What's happening? What can you see when someone starts singing that we can't?
Well, when they're all level, everybody can sing. Everybody can sing to a certain extent. I know you're going to be saying, oh, I can't really sing. Everybody can, and everybody can improve. Everybody can get better. It's all to do with the vibration of the chords, but it's also to do, with the approach. I mean, my approach is to make sure that the way you sing vowels at certain pitches, because the way you sing an R and a low note is different to the way you sing an R and a high note.
Go on, explain.
Well, what an R on a lower note needs more, this is a basic thing, but it needs more of chest resonance, and an R in a higher note needs more head resonance.
All right, I'm going to stop you there, because now it's like you're speaking German to me. My German, I did 1 year of it at school, and it wasn't very good. So they always say singing is a muscle. And now we're talking about three things already connected. You're talking about your vocal cords, you're talking about your head, you're talking about your chest. So, you know, for someone like me, a layman, when I start singing, I use that in a very loose term. But when I do start singing, I don't know really what I'm doing, but there's not a lot of control in it. Are you saying that when you sing, you've got to be using more of your body than just your throat?
Oh, exactly. You should not be thinking about the throat. That's the last thing you should be thinking about. What happens is you've got resonating cavities, shall we say.
Right.
So you've got a chest cavity, you've got the head cavity, the sort of nasal cavities. So you get a balance of that depending on what you're singing. So if you're singing on a low note, you're always going to, you know, a low note down there is much more about chest resonance.
Right.
When you're up on a higher note, that is much more about head resonance. Yeah. Okay. And it's all to do with breathing. It's all to do with breath control, you know, producing the sound. When we're speaking, we don't use much of the mechanics, because we just naturally speak, and it's a much more natural approach. Very often I will say to people, when they're in a sort of low part of the voice, just in a normal, you know, blah, yeah, blah 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 blah, just a comfortable part of the voice, I say stop singing, just stop thinking about singing and just think about the lyrics. because it is much more like speech. When you get higher up, you need more space, you need to open your mouth more, whereas lower down, you don't need to open your mouth so much.
Is it nature or nurture?
Both, definitely. But, yeah, because you know, we're all born, well, most of us are born with a voice of some kind. Mm-hmm. But it is nurture as well, you know, because you can encourage it. I've always find it fascinating, particularly since I started, you know, my work with Helena Chanel and just heard what she did. And I thought, oh my God, there's much more to this than I thought.
Are you good at foreign word pronunciation? Do you pick up foreign languages and things quickly?
Because I've studied in all sorts of languages because of my, you know, because of the way my career's gone. I'm not very good at memorizing. So, very often if I'm doing something in a foreign language, I will have it in front of me. I've got used to it, and I've worked with very good people who are, you know, specialists in a language, like, you know, French, you know, I've done quite a lot of French. I've done quite a lot of French speaking. I've worked on that. So, my French pronunciation is probably the best of all the foreign languages.
Yeah, because I find that, and I'm sure a lot of our listeners like this, I struggle with the foreign languages for pronunciation of words. I was speaking to, I was trying to learn a bit of Italian. I decided to do that, and it's like, well, try and roll your R's. I'm just nowhere near that sort of control. I have literally no idea how I'd roll my R's. And I do think I've just got this sort of pretty monotone, you know, people always like, oh, Tim, are you unhappy? No, it's just the way I speak. It's pretty monotone sort of voice with very little control. Basically can just bang out a bit of English and I'm sort of there and thereabouts. And I wonder if you've got more of a command of your language, you can, you know, I'm all right kicking a football, but I'm not very good at talking, that sort of thing. You might be good at football as well, but, you know, you're good at moving your definitely. Mouth around. No?
I mean, you know, language does affect you technically because French language, everything is slightly more closed. You know, Italian, everything is much more open. Because the Italians don't have diphthongs. They go right. Ah, eh, eh, oh, ooh. They don't go A, E, R, like we do, you know. So the English language can be quite tricky. That's why the Italian language is really the best language to sing in. So it does make quite a difference what language you're singing in. I had a guy that was doing he was doing Les Mis in Korea, mm-hmm. South Korea, and he came to London, and I had a few sessions with him, and he hardly spoke any English, and he was singing in Korean. Now I don't know a single word of Korean. Not a clue. And yeah, I could still work with him. Yeah, we had an interpreter, and the technical stuff. It didn't matter that he was singing in Korean. Technically, all the same stuff applied. Because initially I thought, oh my God, how's this going to work? But you can do exercises, but to work through material that is in a language can be, you know, a bit intimidating, but actually it worked really well.
But the syllable short, I'm really out of my depth here, but it seems to me that in Italian the syllables seem to be a lot longer. They seem to drag their syllables out a bit more, and seems that down in Asia they seem to clip it more, their syllables. Does that translate into the singing, or I might just be talking crap? I don't really know.
I'm not sure about that. Right. I mean, consonants are always, you know, the hurdles for us to get through. You know, if you're running, then, you know, just on a straight, you know, 100 meters to the end, fine. When you've got hurdles are a bit like consonants, you know. And so what I tend to work mainly is making sure that you feel as if you're singing, you're running the the 100 meters without doing the hurdles, and you throw the hurdles in along the way, if that makes sense.
Wow. It kind of doesn't, but I'm really enjoying listening to it, because I'm finding this really fascinating. When people, you said exercises a minute ago, when people do warm-ups, I remember Michael Ball coming into my TV show, and I love Michael Ball, by the way. What just an amazing, just, he is what he says on the tin. His name's Ball, and he just brings a ball with him. He's fantastic.
Yeah, he's amazing, yeah.
He's just so charismatic. He brings the party. But in the makeup room beforehand, he was not singing on the show, by the way, but he decided to warm up his vocals and then decided to get all the people in the makeup room to warm up theirs with him and stuff like that. And he was running through his scales and doing all that. And I really enjoyed watching him do it. And he says, "Darling," or something like that. He said, "You've got to warm up your vocals before you perform." And I'm going on your show to perform.
Yeah, well, you have to, because it.
But what does that mean, warming up your vocals?
Well,
though?
Just means not suddenly go in and singing a big song with big high notes without being warmed up. Without just getting the voice nicely sort of ready for that big song. If you think about an athlete, athletes wouldn't run 4,000 meters or whatever without getting the muscles all ready. And it's the same thing with singing. So humming's a good idea, just doing little exercises like, things like that, to just basically get, waking up. It's like, when you sing first thing in the morning, your voice tends to be down there, and your higher notes are not so good. So you just have to warm up those higher notes so that the muscles are ready. So when you put, more effort in and you have to sing bigger stuff, the muscles are a little bit more aware of it, they're sort of thinking, right, okay, fine, I'm expecting this now. You can't suddenly go, ah! Do you know what I mean? Because your muscles go, oh my god, what the hell was that? Whereas if you've done a little bit of humming to get the body warmed up, then those strong, heavy, big notes are not such a shock to the system.
It's always my favourite bit of a musical is if you get there in time to watch everyone warm up. I just think that's really great, listening to all the people warming up. They're like playing the violin and then a few people doing this and that. And then you singers down there doing their exercises.
You have to do. I very often warm up sort of on my way to something. I'll do it in the street, You know what it's like in London. Nobody takes any notice anyway.
Just that you're another lunatic.
Just another lunatic on the street. Yeah, exactly. So, really, and in fact, I had to take my car to the Menders this morning. And on the way back, I was going over lyrics. And now very often I'll do lyrics on the tube and keep them completely to myself. But actually, because there was nobody much around, I was actually singing out, not loudly, but I was, and it was warming the voice up,
How do you keep a healthy voice? You said 18 years in Cats, did you say, four nights a week?
Yes.
How do you keep your voice healthy? Because, clearly it must put a bit of strain on it to do it every single night, nights a week.
I think the most important thing is, and this is something that I'm always doing with my coaching and my teaching, is that you take the effort out. So you find moments to rest within a song. So you're not constantly bashing. You find moments where you just take the effort out. That's incredibly important. Also, just, basic things like, don't stay up until 4 in the morning, 5 in the morning, and then expect to sing perfectly at 10 o'clock, and just be careful, it's just general health things, eat the right things, drink the right things, drink plenty of water, drink sort of warm liquid, not cold liquid, and not hot.
They always stealth dairy. Do you stealth dairy? I mean, loads of things it gives you mucus.
It affects, you know, some people really can't take dairy because it creates lots of mucus. So all the time you're fighting through the mucus and it gets all a bit, touch wood, I'm pretty okay with dairy. But you know, cheese, milk, you know, it can have an effect because it creates mucus, you know, and then the cords are, you know, can be a bit clogged.
There's a pop star who said, I think I'm going to not name him, but there's a pop star.
Oh, go on.
No, I don't think I am, but there's a pop star, because you can tell me how common it is first, and then maybe I could. But he said to me that when he's on tour, he drops all the songs that either up or down a key, probably down, I think the word is, to take the strain off the vocals, because he says he just can't hit those notes, the ones that he hits in the recording studio. So they take it down and just make it easier to sing and dance and all that sort of stuff.
Well, lower notes are always much easier.
Right. So it's lower for
everybody. You know, like when I've done a lot of film soundtracks. I've done like over 200 film soundtracks, which sometimes been, it's a small team of people. Sometimes, you know, like for the Lord of the Rings, Star Wars films, there can be like 40, 50 of us. I mean, you know, but what happens is that the basses never warm up. They always just turn up, because if you warm the voice up too much, you tend to lose the low notes. Whereas, you know, it's that scenario of, you know, you wake up in the morning and you can, you know, I can sing a bottom C, which I can't sing at 10 o'clock. But if I get up at 5 o'clock in the morning, I can sing a bottom C, you know. So it's the high notes that are harder. And, you know, you just have to be careful that you then don't push to get those. That's why warming up the voice is a good idea.
But is it commonplace for people, pop stars, to do their whole set in a lower key than the ones they're recording it in, because it's just easier to sing?
I wouldn't say it's commonplace. I'm going to go back to Shirley Bassey again. I mean, when she recorded Goldfinger in 63, 64, she sang it in a particular key. And in recent years, she's taken it down fractionally, which I think she did early on. So for 30 odd years or whatever, she was singing it more or less in the same key that she sang it in originally.
Right.
But it is easier if you take things down. Definitely. Definitely.
What happens when you get booked for a job, being in a movie or something? I just don't know what happens with musicians and vocalists. Do you have to audition for it, or do they just book you now? Is that what just everyone just gets booked?
Well, generally, yeah. I mean, you know, for sessions, there are fixers who, you know, are called up by the production company, and they'll say, right, we need this type of voice. You know, I've done jingles and things, and they ask the fixer to find somebody who will be able to do this particular job the right way, and they know the right people to ring. And you know, so the fixers are terribly important, because they have to get it right, particularly if it's a solo job. I work for a particular fixer, and she often rings me because they don't know what they want. You know, I had to sing the Frog Chorus once for a travel ad, I'm often called because I'm a bit of a jack of all trades. I wouldn't say I'm particularly great at any of them, but I can change my voice and do different styles. So if the production company is not quite sure what they want, very often I'm booked because I can adapt and try and work out what it is they want. You know, when you're in the studio, sometimes they don't know.
Right.
Sometimes they don't actually know, and I have to work out what it is. I remember doing a TV thing. Can't remember what it was called now, but I did the recording. I thought it sounded absolutely fine. And they said, oh, yeah, thanks, Mike. Yeah, I think we've got what we need. And I thought, no, you haven't. I could just tell that they hadn't got what they needed. So I said, I don't think you have. I said, let's just have a think. Because I thought, I'm not going to go away and then say, oh no, we're going to find somebody else. And I thought, no, I wanted to make sure that I nailed it. Yeah. You know? So I said, what about if I make the voice sound older? And they went, oh, yeah, maybe. So I went back in the studio, redid it. And they went, oh my God, that's it. Yeah, that's it. Great.
Brilliant.
You know, but it's... Sometimes, you know, they don't know exactly what they want until they hear it, you know.
I used to do voiceovers. Well, I haven't done any for years. If anyone wants to book me for a voiceover, I'll do it, by the way. But I used to do them, and then someone told me once, I'd go in and I'd just, it was like two lines, and I'd do it, and I thought I'd nailed it. And they go, another one, please. Can you just do one with a more emphasis on, can you do another one with a da, 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 da?
Yeah.
And one of my mates who was in the industry said, look, go in, do the first three or four as badly as you possibly can, just make them shit. Then when you do a good one, they'll go, that's the one we're looking for. Yeah, never go in with your best one, because exactly. They never will be happy with the best one. They'll keep moving it or keep pushing it down
exactly,
the line. So
exactly, yeah.
So is it competitive between you all then in the world? I assume you're quite tight as an industry. I'm sure you'll know each other, but is it competitive who gets the work and who doesn't? Are you in competition with your
fellow vocalists? There's always competition. I'm sure we all feel the same, because we've had, you know, honest conversation, you know, with people who do same sort of thing as me. You know, you see, and particularly with things like Facebook and Instagram and all of those things, you see and you hear what other people are doing and you think, why wasn't I asked to do that? You know, I'd like to have done that, you know, or I would have been right, you know. But I think you just have, and you know, because I've been doing it for quite a long time, I try and be philosophical about it, and I just look at the things that I have done and think, well, actually, I did that, and I did that, and that was great, and I enjoyed doing that, and you know, we can't all do everything the whole time. Do you know what I mean? Mm. There are things that I do, and I think, oh, I'm really pleased I've done that, and I know that there'll be other people thinking, well, I could have done that. You know, why has he got that job again? Do you know what I mean? It, you know, it's inevitable, you know, and it's the same in all professions, you know. And there are times when I haven't got a job and I think, you know, I'll see somebody on the telly or I'll see somebody, you know, listen to somebody on the radio or doing a concert or whatever. I'll see them in the publicity and I'll be thinking, oh, God, I wish I'd been asked to do that, you know. But, you know, it's sort of inevitable, but you just have to think, I'm happy with what I am doing. And, you know, as long as I keep doing it and keep doing nice things, then, you know, that's, you know, you can't do everything.
How long can you do it for? I mean, does it get to a stage where you, I don't know, you get into your 80s or 90s or something and the voice just can't do it anymore?
Well, yeah, I mean, there will come a time. I went to see Charles Aznavour at the Albert Hall, I think it was about a year before he died, and he was something, I think he was 90, 91. Mm-hmm. You know, people like Tony Bennett, Charles Aznavour always had, you know, we were talking about this earlier. It was more a sort of speechy voice. He was never the greatest singer, but he was the, you know, great stylist. You know, he didn't have the greatest voice, but the way he conveyed songs was just incredible, incredible actor. Tony Bennett is an amazing singer and can still sing brilliantly at his, you know, his great age. I mean, sadly, you know, he has dementia. So that is stopping him performing now. But the voice is still tip top, you know. He just did something with the last thing he did with Lady Gaga at Radio City Music Hall.
Right. Yeah.
And voice still sounding amazing, you know.
Okay. How much has auto-tune changed the game?
I don't like it. It has changed it, and you can fix it, but you can fix tuning, you can fix notes, they can go in and take one section of a note and fix it. But you very often can hear it. You can hear it. It doesn't sound as natural. I you know, when I've recorded stuff and I think, oh, yeah, that, you know, that note was not quite right, and they'll say, oh, it's all right, we can fix it. I'll say, no, have we got time? Let me do it again. Because I'd much rather it be right, you know, and it be naturally right, rather than somebody, you know, tweaking it. I mean, certain people, I'm not going to name any names, but certain people, you know, have great careers, but can't really do it live because you can't auto-tune a live performance because, you know, whoever's doing the auto-tuning can't fix that note until after they've sung it. Mm. Do you know what I mean? You can do it in the studio. So you know, there are certain people who make amazing recordings, and yet you get them to do it live, you know, forget it.
It's made a huge impact, though, hasn't it? It really has, because as you say there, you can get people singing who are not hitting every note, and because they can't, we know they can't do it live. We've all watched them. We've all gone to gigs and seen, all gone to a festival and seen people not do it. And yet the singles work for them, or the albums or the recording, sorry, works for them. It's a weird thing, auto-tune, isn't it? It's a real cheat. I wonder if it's thought of as the enemy by vocalists, or, you know, it's kind of a cheat for your industry, isn't it, I suppose?
It is a bit of a cheat, but then, you know, I was just thinking then that, you know, of course, you know, one of the most recent things that happens in studios is Pro Tools. So, you know, you record something and you record it maybe three times. Part of it may be great and part of it may not be great. So they think what they can do now is they can say, well, look, we'll use that bit from the other take that you did and we'll add it to the already good bit. So you've got two good bits rather than one good bit on one take and another good bit on another. You put them together. So in a way, that's slightly fake as well, because it's not, as you originally sang, the one take. But in a way, that doesn't matter because it's still you doing it, even though, you know, the first line is from one take and the second line is from another take. So, you know... the various degrees of how much, you know, you're a fraud or you're honest, you know.
Interesting watching that Beatles documentary, though, when they, you know, they were just sort of banging out tunes, and the rawness of that was what I think got everyone so excited about it. You know, there's a lot of bands coming on my show at the moment, or artists coming on my show going, we're recording it as live. But I think that probably means they do exactly what you say. They record it as live 300 times and take the best bits for each one. But they're trying to do it. But I think people are trying to get that feel to it. As fans of music, when we're listening, I think we like it when it isn't quite right, and I think that becomes a beautiful thing. Look, you go back to vinyl, when we all had vinyl years ago, and there was like in your favorite song there'd be a slight scratch or something. It kind of becomes part of that personality, doesn't it, which you don't get when it's all perfectly auto-tuned and moved around. And I think that's what people want a bit of sometimes.
I think it's nice because we anything that connects with the heart, and if something is natural, we really love it. You know, we don't always know when we can tell when something's not right. Remember my flatmate, you know, we'd be watching somebody on the telly and he would know when something wasn't quite, when somebody was performing a live performance and he was like, oh, that wasn't quite right. He wouldn't know what it was. I would know what it was. The connection from, you know, to the heart. Sometimes we don't care that somebody might sing slightly out of tune or it might not be 100% right. It's because it's emotional and it's coming from their heart to our heart, you know, and that's what we connect to.
We're running out of time. Just a couple more things. First thing is, what do you think you've done so much? I hate these questions, by the way, but I'm going to ask you anyway, just to see if we can find an answer. People ask me all the time. I never know the answer to this, but you've done so much. Is there one moment that you think, wow, this was incredible? Is there sort of like a highlight in your career that you just look back and pinch yourself a bit?
I've been asked this so many times.
Crap question. I'm sorry.
Well, no, it's not a crap question. It's a really good question. The only thing I would say is that there are lots of them.
Yeah.
Do you know what I mean? And it depends what the situation, you know, go back to the Albert Hall. You know, first time I walked on the Albert Hall stage was when I was with Swingles. And just having, you know, been there as a kid in the audience to actually walk out and perform there myself, that was really exciting. That was when I was part of a team. But going out for the first time and hearing the response from the audience at the end of my first song as a soloist, that is probably, you know, that is one of the highlights. But I've been very lucky because I've performed in lots of great venues lots of times, and just getting the response from the audience. You know, performing in my hometown last year, the response from the audience just when I walked on was, you know, it sort of stopped me in my tracks. You know,
what's your hometown now? Grimsby hometown. Yeah. Oh wow! From Grimsby to Royal Albert Hall back to Grimsby.
Exactly. Well, I've always gone back, you know, there every sort of 2-3 years and done a concert. This particular concert was to help raise money for the Central Hall, which is an amazing venue in Grimsby. And it was just, you know, there were times when they're needing, you know, things done. This time they needed the roof fixing. So yeah. I said, well, look, I'll come and do a concert. I won't take anything for it. You know, let's just see if we can make money. And that was, you know, it's always great performing to your home crowd. Great, you know, Carnegie Hall was really exciting the first time. But your home crowd's really important because those, you know, a lot of those people saw you grow up, you know, and heard you sing from a child or whatever. And just going back there this time, because I haven't been for a while, just the, you know, the response was just really exciting. It was lovely.
My favourite bit of that was when you went, you know, playing Carnegie Hall the first time.
Well, actually, it's funny because I played the Lincoln Center in New York more times than Carnegie Hall, but there's just something special about it. You know, yeah. I tell you what was disappointing the first time I went there was the dressing rooms. It's all modernized.
Oh, and no, you don't want
yeah,
that.
It just, I thought, oh my God, I, you know, yeah. I wanted to see, you know, somebody scratched on the wall, yeah. You know, Judy was here sort of thing, you know, none of that was all. So that was the most disappointing thing about that.
Michael, I've run out of time now because we try and keep it an hour. Just very quick answer to this, if you can. What does singing make you feel like? How does it make you feel?
Now this is the electricity song, you know, electricity from Billy Elliot, which I've sung a number of times. It still excites me, and I've done it for a long time. There's, you know, I've always done it. I've done it since I can remember, you know, since I was about 5 or something. It makes me feel great, and I there's nothing like it.
Does it feel like work ever?
Yeah, it does feel like work sometimes. I think the thing is, it doesn't matter what you're doing. Sometimes I'm doing things and I'm thinking, I don't particularly love this, you know, but I'm doing it because I've been booked to do it. Sometimes I'm doing it and I think, oh my God, this is just amazing. The only times I don't enjoy it is if I feel something's a little bit too high or I haven't had enough time to rehearse it.
Mm.
But it's always just one last thing. It can always be scary because even if you know something really well, you can always be slightly distracted and there's always a possibility you can go wrong. So, you know, even though you're enjoying it, you've always got to be aware just to make sure that you don't fall off. If you relax too much, sometimes, you know, you might be vulnerable to falling off. But there's nothing, you know, nothing better for me. It's what I've always done and what I love.
Brilliant. Thank you so much for joining us, Michael. If you want to follow Michael, go to his website, which is justyourname.com, is it?
It's michaeldoor.com, yeah.
michaeldoor.com. Thank you so much.
My pleasure, Tim. It's been lovely to talk to you.
I've thoroughly enjoyed it. Thank you. I've learned a lot.
Thank you.